This is WJBC This Week.
This extensive investigation has concluded with an overwhelming amount of evidence that Glinowitz's death was a carefully staged suicide.
Frankly, we should have had a budget with compromises done last June.
This program has allowed me one really fine meal a day at noon.
Please understand that these home-delivered meals are not delivered at the whim of a participant.
I am not willing to relinquish my authority or responsibility and abdicate that.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stark. On this week's program, a Bloomington alderman who's been a frequent critic of the city's spending explains his opposition to the city's budget task force. The David Davis Mansion struggles to stay open while the state squabbles over a budget. Downtown Bloomington celebrates its artistry. A Rolling Stone editor, Steve Knopper, discusses his biography of Michael Jackson, plus WJBC's Throwback Thursday interview with Ebus, Elizabeth Estes. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Ever since he was elected to the Bloomington City Council 2 years ago, Ward 1 Alderman Kevin Lauer has been a vocal critic of the city's spending. The city developed a task force earlier this year to come up with ways to trim the budget for the city council to consider. Lauer has sat out much of the proceedings, seemingly out of protest. He talked with WJBC's Scott Lachlan and Colleen Reynolds this week.
You didn't vote for a single thing on the recommendation sheet. Why? Because there were some fewer outside consultants. Who wouldn't vote for that? I would.
Actually, this was put together by the Budget Task Force, and it ran through them. With all due respect, that was three elected officials and then some citizens. And so, I am not willing to relinquish my authority or responsibility and abdicate that to a group that, is mostly non-elected officials. Send my cuts in and then have them either approve or disapprove. That doesn't seem to be the way that most elected officials should be required to have their ideas
But they don't approve or disapprove. It comes down to the city council approves or disapproves.
And
well,
just set
and
that aside.
That's the point. I'm happy to work on this, but I need to be at the table when I do that, and that was taking me out of the loop.
Set that aside for 1 minute.
Sure.
Alderman Black said to you, craft a proposal. I would be very willing to discuss it as a council. Where's your proposal?
We haven't done anything more than verbally talk about this. Now, they sent some written things in very early to the Budget Task Force, and that's what you're seeing here. I don't believe that anyone else has really formally even written a budget. This is all just discussion at this point.
Right,
I don't think that there's necessary, amendments to something that's not even been crafted yet.
But okay, so, Alderman Lauer, you didn't answer my question, really.
Sure. Well,
what is preventing you from coming up with your own proposals
and presenting them
to the council as part of consideration? You heard Alderman Black saying, I'm ready.
And that's exactly what we were doing. That's what we were discussing right then and there. He is wanting something in writing that no one else has done. And so I guess I could do that, but this is awfully early in the discussion to be asking for amendments to something that hasn't even been written.
Well, you say that all we're doing is talking about it right now. What would you recommend be done at this point?
Well, we need to talk about not continuing to do a zoo expansion. We need to talk about why we're expanding the library at this time. We need to talk about why we need to continue to work on a very, very expensive downtown lighting project. They're talking about downtown parking.
Okay. Oh, yeah, we got that. We got that in your audio clip.
Property and additional bike paths.
Weren't all of these, a lot of those things you mentioned, proposed to be talked about, and you didn't vote one way or the other on, yeah, I'd be interested in discussing more?
No, actually, a few of those were in there, yes. But, again, that went through the budget task force. I didn't elect to partake in that. And so this will, you know, be a continuing discussion.
Okay, maybe I'm lost then. Help me out. Help me through this because I'm a slow learner here. From what I understood, this budget task force, which I believe three elected officials are on, right?
Right.
All right. And how many are non-elected?
I believe there's four or five.
Okay.
I'm not really sure.
All right. So they were going to come up with proposals. All right. Mm-hmm. Then the council would discuss or vote on priorities. All right. And some of these received no votes from anyone. Which means I look at that as saying, okay, that's not even on the table anymore. That's not even worth discussing. But others were, and it was an opportunity for you to have your voice heard by saying, for example, yeah, I would like to see some costs cut with the golf course, for example.
Sure.
But you didn't vote on that.
Again, I would like to be at the table when we begin that.
But you will be at the table. You will be at the table eventually. It's going to come down. You guys are going to get together. You have to vote as a city council. You have to vote on these. You've got the final say.
Yes, and that's the point. So, and that's the entire point. I'm not willing to, abdicate my responsibility.
You don't like the process. You don't like the process.
I don't.
So you're not participating at all.
I didn't participate in that, Colleen. I am participating very, very much so. I've been at every meeting that we've had.
You didn't vote to
take and play them.
Why didn't you vote for something like cut back on printing? Very straightforward. Seems like a reasonable suggestion.
And you're not voting to cut back on printing. You're voting to discuss cutting back on printing.
Yeah, I understand.
I mean, why wouldn't you do that?
I elected to take my ideas outside that particular written discussion with the budget task force. That's all that happened here.
You vote no on a lot of issues when it comes to spending any money.
Right.
You don't. You're one that if it's not for the roads, then it's not worth spending.
Here's the problem. This kind of convolutes a lot of the large things that are non-essential to the city. We did not have any discussion. Nothing on there gave me a choice to look at the Coliseum, the BCPA.
Yes. BCPA is on the list. It's at the top of the list. BCPA changes, including items 9, 10, 11, and 12, 13, 25 from the template. You didn't vote. It got the most votes.
Jointly managing the BCPA and the Coliseum together, outsourcing golf operations, selling a golf course. Those are big expenditure items.
And by the way, I'm for selling a golf course. I don't live in your district, but I'm for selling one of the golf courses. You didn't vote on that. You had the opportunity to vote, and you chose not to.
Selling the Creativity Center.
I chose not to partake in that particular discussion in terms of what the budget task force came up with, because I have my own. And so, no, I don't think that I have...
Okay, you have your own. Let's go back to Scott Black. You have your own. Scott Black says, propose it. What I get, Scott Black asked you, hey, bring a proposal up, share it with us, sway us, educate us. Why wouldn't you do that?
I am and I have been. It just doesn't happen to be...
on paper. You've had proposals on paper? You've had written proposals?
Give them to us. Give them to the media. Talk about them. Let's publicly discuss them.
And we are.
No, we're not.
Yes.
Where are they?
I see.
We're open to that. So if you have something, we can schedule another time on the air and we can talk about it.
Let's do it now. We've got 2 minutes. BCPA changes. Are you for some BCPA changes? Maybe private management?
Yeah, and Yes, and we are looking at that, right.
Golf course, we're talking Highland here. Do you think you sell it or hand over the reins to a company that will operate it? What would you prefer?
That is a deeper discussion. Highland was a park prior. It's my belief that it could be operated at a break even and not cost the city additional money from the general fund every year, at least for a short period of time until our economy recovers. And that should be a discussion that we have. The other two are very expensive as well. And whether we sell one of those or not, I'm not really sure. I think that we could cut back on a lot of the things that we are doing there and make them break even for a short term.
That was Bloomington Alderman Kevin Lauer with Scott and Colleen. The David Davis Mansion State Historic Site in Bloomington is in considerable financial constraints and is struggling to keep the lights on. Acting Site Superintendent Jeannie Reardon talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Do we have to worry about David Davis closing?
Not as we have in the past, where it was because personnel were being laid off or they were simply going to shut us down because they didn't want us. But from the standpoint that our electric bill, our gas bill, haven't been paid since July 1st, possibly, how long do you ask Ameren not to take any money before they decide that's long enough?
Have they sent you a shutoff notice?
No, they have not. I think oftentimes they work those things out on a large level. They all know they eventually will be paid, but smaller business people, such as the person who takes care of our HVAC system, we have a large repair going on right now, and we've asked him, is it all right with you? It may be several months, and he's aware of that, and he's willing to accept that. But a lot of smaller businesses can't do that.
Yeah, it makes me sad because the David Davis Mansion brings in so many people that spend money at the mom-and-pop places around town. And does anybody in Springfield realize that? That is money that if we were open 7 days a week, David Davis, there would be so much more money coming into the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last year we brought in $750,000 into the community. And that was with two full-time personnel and about 100 volunteers. I think, they do know that the sites are valuable. I believe the governor is viewing us as tourism, and he is aware that that is an industry. It's not just a frill. So all indications from where I'm sitting, which, grant you, is not the full view, but all indications are that there's no plans to actually shutter the doors.
Well, I did a test. I went online to the Illinois Tourism Council or whatever, and I ordered a travel guide. It showed up 4 days later. Mm-hmm. So there's no delays in getting those out.
Right, so. Right. And a lot of tourism is also private-based. There is money that comes in from private sources. We are very, very fortunate at the Davis Mansion that we have a private foundation that helps support us. I don't want to ask them to pay the Ameren bill. If I had to, they probably could come up with it at least once. So we're fortunate in that respect.
That was Jeannie Reardon of the David Davis Mansion with Terry James. Michael Jackson was the king of pop, but was known for much more than just his music. Rolling Stone contributing editor Steve Knopper wrote a book called The Genius of Michael Jackson, where he peels back the many layers of the world's most famous pop star whose life was cut short. Knopper talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
With a subject as famous as Michael Jackson, who was, in the last 20 years of his life, the subject of tabloid fodder, is it hard to separate art and how it was made from the mythology?
It can be, but I found that part of it wasn't that hard, actually. I mean, for a number of reasons. The first is that Michael kept those things separate. You know, when he was working on his music throughout his entire career, everything else got shut out, you know, especially early on when he was making the early albums with Quincy Jones and the rest. He would go into the studio and he would just be there focused, and he would be in there for hours and hours and hours, staying up all night in these dark rooms, putting all the great music together. And so what I did was interview all the people who work with him, the engineers, the musicians, the producers, all the different people who put these records together, and there were a lot of them. And they all had a very specific type of impression of him as Michael Jackson, working musician. And so it was easy to really kind of hone in on that and focus it. And then later in his career and elsewhere in his life, you get into these extraneous activities, the tabloid stuff, all the various issues. I kind of felt like that was a whole separate category, and that required a whole different set of sources in most cases.
But at one point, didn't he have his chimp in the studio?
He did. He sometimes did bring Bubbles into the studio with him. Yeah, in fact, I have a little bit on that in the book.
So a little bit of the eccentricity did enter into the workday.
That's true. You make a good point there. You know, he played games. He brought Macaulay Culkin into the studio when they were making one of the records, and they would run around and have water balloon fights and play video games. And, you know, he would bring the chimpanzee into the studio, and there was silliness and craziness, and he would dress like Michael Jackson. So for sure, you make a good point about that. When I think about sort of extracurricular activity and tabloid stuff, I think more about, like, you know, child molestation and facial surgery and all that different kind of stuff. And none of that stuff served as a distraction to making music throughout his career.
Well, the whole thing comes as a package. You said that all of the major stars are weird in one way or another. Elvis was weird. Brian Wilson was and is still weird. Michael Jackson was certainly weird. Does the fame make them weird, or does the weirdness drive what makes them famous?
That's like asking which comes first, the chicken or the egg. It's an impossible question to answer. But I guess what I would say is that I think you need to have a certain type of personality to make it in show business in general, but more specifically in pop music, to be a pop star or to be in rock and roll. And in order to succeed, you have to have a little bit of weirdness. I mean, all those people that you mentioned, from Mick Jagger to Kurt Cobain, you know, on and on and on, you have to be the kind of person that likes that kind of lifestyle, standing up in front of people and being a certain kind of heavily sexual rock or pop star. Certainly, there's some kind of weirdness that those of us who sit around at a desk all day can't really fit into our lifestyle, into our career ambition.
There are a lot of little details you reveal about the creation of his image, from the plastic surgeries to the style that he developed to break himself away from being Michael of the Jackson 5 into his own persona, the dance moves he studied, the fashion. And these things weren't always from obvious places. For instance, Adam Ant inspired those military-style jackets, apparently.
Yeah. Adam Ant took credit for it, and there is a lot of documentation that suggests that that was true. Adam Ant and Michael actually had a little bit of a friendship. Like, Adam came to the U.S. on some kind of promotional tour. I interviewed him at length. And visited Michael's house and spent the day with Michael and his family and kind of hung around and met all the Jacksons, which was a little surreal. Here's this kind of like punk rock guy from England coming over and nobody knows who the hell he is, but he was there. And then, of course, he performed a little bit of a surreal performance on the Motown 25 special. And he performed after, as memory serves, he performed after Michael's famous moonwalk performance. And it was sort of like, oh, God, I have to follow that, you know, kind of thing.
Well, you mentioned the moonwalk and his dance moves, which I think that Motown 25 performance really served as a bit of a really, hey, pay attention to what I can do as a solo artist for Michael Jackson. And when it came to his dance moves, he took them from everywhere. But it might surprise some people that Fred Astaire was an influence for this kid who came from Motown.
Yeah, absolutely. Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly. I mean, Michael would, on the Destiny Tour, just to name one example of how influenced he was and how immersed he was in those old classic dance movies, Michael actually took an early VCR, a video cassette machine, around with him on tour and a TV on the tour bus. And he was constantly watching old Fred Astaire movies, The Bandwagon on down. And he just was mesmerized by Fred Astaire. And, you know, and there were many other influences, too. I mean, obviously, you have to say that a great deal of the moonwalk influence came from African-American culture, moves that he learned from Soul Train, moves that he learned from people like Jeffrey Daniel and Casper and Cooley, who were dancers on Soul Train and kind of developed this backslide move from other sources, and they kind of taught it to Michael directly. And then in addition to that, he also had this influence that came from mime. So when he was a kid, he got to know Robert Shields from, remember the old mime duo, Shields and Yarnell. And Robert Shields had a big toy collection, and little Michael, when he was a kid, would visit Robert's house. And Robert was older, and he would sort of say, go away, kid, you bother me. And then Michael would start asking him questions about mining. And, you know, eventually Robert's moves, the old Shields and Yarnell routine clinkers, influenced Michael's moves in the robot. And that sort of indirectly led to the moonwalk. So, you know, great artists steal. They appropriate. And that's what Michael was up to. And he grabbed the bits of the moonwalk from a million different sources, and he put them all together and put it into this one amazing dance. And, you know, that's why I think it fits the title, Genius.
Michael Jackson did not see the world the way that most people do. And sometimes that can require a bit of a translator. And in Michael Jackson's case, was Quincy Jones able to communicate with Michael in a special way? Did he have a special understanding of his talent?
Yes, I mean, I think so. The way I've been putting it is that Michael and Quincy were two geniuses who were working together in the studio. And Michael heard music. He heard symphonies in his head. And he had to be able to translate those to either someone who played the instrument or someone who could write down the music for him. And Quincy Jones was sort of the ultimate person who did that. Quincy Jones, for a brief period or for a few years there, was kind of a father figure to him. He was, I've been kind of likening him to Phil Jackson, a basketball coach like Phil Jackson, who doesn't really push you. He's not the kind of coach who's going to scream at you. He's the kind that's going to bring your talent out of you and make you be a leader, sort of without you even knowing it. And that's the kind of personality that Quincy had, and he was perfect for Michael for those three albums. And I also want to just add that after Michael and Quincy stopped working together, Michael continued to make great albums, Dangerous and History and Invincible. So it wasn't all Quincy.
You were able to get access to a recording of a conversation between Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson that was either during or after they both had worked on the movie The Wiz, Berry Gordy's R&B version of The Wizard of Oz. And this is a very interesting recording. It was very telling in how they were able to build their relationship.
Yes, absolutely. I had a source leak me a box of cassette tapes. And Michael recorded himself when he was a young man. He would walk around with a tape recorder in the 70s and 80s, long before iPhones, obviously. And he would record conversations. He would record ideas, off the top of his head things. And one of the conversations that I was able to be privy to was a phone conversation, one of the very first between Michael and Quincy after they'd met on the set of The Wiz. And this was roughly 78, maybe early 79. And Quincy's doing most of the talking. He's rambling, which is I gather, how Quincy talks. And he's going on and on and on. And Michael's kind of going, interesting. And at one point he goes, woo, which was really great. And at a certain point, Quincy's going on and on like that, and then Michael says, I hear music in my head. And then there's this pause, and Quincy kind of finally gathers himself and says, Michael, if you hear music in your head, I can help you write that down. And to me, I felt very lucky to have been able to listen to this conversation, because to me, that was the moment of their partnership, when it sort of was the moment of conception, where the two of them figured out what their roles were and how they were going to help each other make an amazing and very profitable record.
That was Michael Jackson biographer Steve Knopper with our Steve Fast. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Downtown Bloomington is often known for its bars and live entertainment, but there's a pocket to the city's central business district that's highly regarded, but perhaps not as well known. A handful of artists make up what they've called the Around the Corner Artist Group. Perhaps Bloomington's best-known artist, Herb Eaton, and his wife, Pamela, joined WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
More people appreciating Herb's art now that they're all trying to do these little paint by number classes with wine. You know, Merlot and a Masterpiece is a fun get together place where people try and go, am I Picasso? And most of them come out going, nope, not even close. But are more people walking into your gallery going, ooh, I now see the time and talent that it takes to make these pieces?
I don't know if there's any effect from them. They're just out my back door. They're great. I'm glad they're doing that. People ask me to do that, and you don't want me to teach a class like that. Okay, except
sure.
Maybe to drink the wine. But the I don't know if there's any improvement or change in any way, shape, or form, except that we're glad that people are coming downtown and linking downtown with an idea of art and, you know, being able to have a nice glass of wine and, you know, the experience of community that they do. I think that's really really a neat thing that they do with that.
Because after going to some of those classes, as I told you off the air, I went and got a beginner paint set just to see if, well, maybe I'd be better if I could just be abstract. Nope, not at all.
Well, to answer that question from my angle, and most of you who know Herb and Pam know that we each have totally opposite angles, people will come to me and say, Pam, will Herb do some art classes? Mm-hmm. Because I'm looking at his Mackinac landscapes now, and I'm looking at the trees, and I'm looking at how he's building the structure with the whole ambiance of the scene of being out in the country. And I want that. Will he teach that to me? So we did do a couple series of Make Your Mark at Eaton Gallery. And the way that Herb instructs, and the reason I know that is because I had to be one of his students, and he said I was the worst student that he ever taught because I was, like yourself, so frustrated. I was a phys ed teacher. The only class I ever flunked in my life was 3 hours of art, actually, in college. And so I have learned to appreciate not only his work but all the artists that are downtown now because I see the time that it takes. You know, sometimes they'll do a sketch like the artist trading cards, and they'll say, oh, I can whip this up in, you know, just a few minutes. But they've had years of experience of creating, it comes natural for them. It doesn't for someone like you and I.
I asked Herb when he brought in one of these trading cards, and you so kindly gifted it to me, and I will treasure it forever. I know it took 40 years of experience for you to be able to do this in such a short period of time. I just said, just out of curiosity, how long did it take you to do that? And he's like, yeah, a minute, you know, but it's a minute well spent of your time.
Actually, the trouble with most people is they spend too much time and stuff. The freedom, now one of the things that comes from learning a skill, which, you know, I have an MFA, you learn a skill, good teachers and all the rest of that stuff, and practicing that skill, whether it's playing the piano or, you know, swinging on a tightrope or whatever have you, when you finally get to that point, the pleasure other people get from it is to see the ease that which you do that. Mm-hmm. And so if the ones that took longer than a minute, basically I tore them up, threw them away, because they start looking real tight and they start not having this sort of flow to them and what have you. Well, I just throw them away. So all of my bad things are in the landfill. You might want to just dig through the landfill.
It might be more affordable art in the landfill, I'm just saying. But we do want to support our artisans, and you do have a bigger community than ever before in downtown Bloomington, of which I credit the two of you for helping start, because they saw your success with the gallery and said, oh, maybe we can, you know, kind of hop on board. And that's why we have the Eatons in today to talk about Around the Corner Artist Group. Pam, who's all in the group?
Well, this group has evolved since 2000. It started off with Herb, of course, Angel Ambrose, Kay Seafield, and then at the time, Rick Harney. And then it evolved to the five artists that we have now, which, again, is Herb Eaton, Angel Ambrose, Joanne Getzinger, Darren Dowdy, and Jeff Little. So the group consists of five artists, and we are named Around the Corner Artist Group because it's a group of people that truly have studios around the corner from each other.
That was Herb and Pamela Eaton with Susan Saunders. Elizabeth Estes, or Ebus as she was known on air, wore many hats for WJBC as she helped carry the legendary voice into the 20th century before leaving in 2001. Ebus talked with WJBC's Terry James this week in our Throwback Thursday interview.
WJBC alum, and where did you get that name?
Yeah, you know, my parents weren't mean, and I actually gave it to myself. When I was a little girl, I couldn't say Elizabeth and Estes together, and I said Ebus, and it stuck like the plague. And my family, that's all they call me. But for the most part in my professional life, I've gotten out of it a little bit. So people call me Elizabeth or E now, but when I come home and on the radio, I'll always be Ebus.
Now, you were able to join us for our 90th anniversary, and what was cool is you actually went on and you did a three-hour show. Just like the old days. I mean, how did that feel?
You know what? It's so funny. I was probably more nervous doing that than I was in the entirety of the time I did the shows on JBC. It's hard to get back into it. I mean, it is a little bit like riding a bike, but you have to really think about, okay, the timing and who you want to get on. And, oh, I put a lot of effort and time and stress into that. But I really enjoyed being back on and hearing my friends and seeing my friends and really celebrating JBC, which is it always will be in the radio business, a legend radio station.
You know, the years really run together, and I need you to define for me what years you were here, what shifts you had, and what did you do here at the radio station?
Oh, man, you didn't tell me I was going to have to do that. I'm going to have to think back in
it's
the
like
noggin,
a pop
but,
quiz.
You know, I actually started in the sales department. And so I did a couple different things at JBC, but I started in sales. And then Don Munson asked me to do some fill-in one time when Dick Lutke went on vacation. And then the next thing you know, I ended up doing some sidekick stuff with him and then ended up being, you know, being a part of the radio station. I know I left in 2001, actually, and the reason I know that is I left in February of 2001 to go to KOA Radio in Denver and the Clear Channel Radio Group out there running some news talk stations, and I remember it vividly because I was living in Denver when September 11th happened. So I left in February of 01. I started in the radio business in the early 90s, so I was there for a while in different roles and in different parts of what I did.
So if you look back at some of the memories that you had here at WJBC, what are some of your favorites?
You know, well, the favorites generally would revolve around the people I met. You know, two of my best friends to this day I met working at the radio station, you know, Julie Hebding and Janae Henson, and we're still best friends to this day. So my first memories would be about the fact that I have made lifelong friends there, and also probably one of the best mentors and friends I have is Red Pitcher. So from that perspective, the friends I've made, Colleen Reynolds, Susan Jenner, all those guys, I think the best memory is the fact that we kind of grew up together and we helped build a radio station together and we're still the best of friends. Beyond that, some of the things that we did, you know, one of my funniest memories was, the many things that I did with Don Munson, but one was when we actually took a bike trip down Constitution Trail, and we broadcast live from it. And I kind of told this story the day I was on. It seemed like a really good idea at the time that we would broadcast the morning show from Constitution Trail as they added on the extensions, except Don was a biker and I wasn't. So pretty much through the whole show, you could just hear me breathing heavy. So, you know, that was a fun one. I think my favorite thing I ever did was when I got to fly with the Thunderbirds. That was an amazing experience to be able to fly in the F-16 through the Bloomington Normal Air Show and broadcast live from that. I mean, it's an experience I still talk about. I'll go to meetings today and, you know, you'll have facilitators who will say, tell us something that nobody knows about you. And I usually say, I've flown with the F-16. So that was a great experience. And then all the stuff that I got to do with Illinois State, with the play-by-play, Joel Hutchison, those types of things always rank at the top of my mind of the amazing experiences that I had at JBC.
Funny you bring her up. We just had Jill Hutchison on the air the other day, actually, doing some reminiscing. You know, the callers here at the radio station, I really watched you have a lot of fun on our 90th anniversary day, and I imagine the callers were a big part of your day here as well back when you worked here.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I know a lot of them because they would call in the show or I would see them at different events. But it's weird that they know you. And so I'll still be in Bloomington Normal and I'll laugh in a restaurant and someone will come over to me and say, are you Ebus? And they know me from my time on the radio station. So yeah, just being able to engage. And I think the best part of being a radio talk show host, and I'll be honest, it's the part that I miss the most about, being on the air, was that it allowed you to meet a lot of new people, get a lot of different opinions, but it also fed an insatiable curiosity. If you're curious at all, if you get a chance to host a radio show, you can feed that curiosity because you see something and you think, oh, I'm going to get an expert on to explain that to me, or I can get someone on that knows more than I do and can tell me what that is. And then you can engage people to get their opinions on what you've heard. And I do miss that interaction. I miss being able to just pick up the phone and say, hey, it's Elizabeth Estes from WJBC, and I'm wondering if you could come on the air with me and talk about whatever it is. So I do miss that, and I miss the engagement with the callers from that perspective as well.
That was Elizabeth Estes with Terry James in our Throwback Thursday interview. The Weekend News is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Governor Rauner spoke about the state's budget impasse and again touted his turnaround agenda during a stop in Bloomington this week. Rauner told the crowd, made up mainly of McLean County Chamber of Commerce members, he's cautiously optimistic a budget will be passed by mid-January.
Frankly, we should have had a budget with compromises done last June. The reason I think in the next 60, 90 days it'll happen is because Chicago needs the help. They're running out of money. And after January 1st, it only needs a simple majority vote in legislature to get anything done. Right now, it needs a supermajority.
Rauner says he's not willing to just pass a tax increase to balance the budget. He says he's meeting frequently with the leaders of the State House and Senate, but hasn't met with them all at once because he says he's found a better progress while meeting one-on-one. Or the governor wouldn't say how many prospects there are to possibly buy the Mitsubishi plant, but said one thing that's keeping potential buyers away is Illinois' poor business climate.
Our property taxes are too high. Our corporate income taxes are not competitive, but workers' comp, tort system, and just the regulatory burden and the red tape, punishing for businesses, especially for manufacturing firms.
And the fallout continues from the lack of a state budget. As Dave Dahl reports, the spotlight is on seniors.
The message on the marquee says it all. Closed every Friday due to no state budget. This senior services center is of concern to Julie Hubbard, who runs the Area Agency on Aging for Lincoln Land.
We were to receive $2 million in federal funding and $1 million in state funding to award to the local service providers for FY 2016. This lack of state funding means that information and assistance providers will receive only 54% of the funds they need to answer questions and assist people obtain the services and benefits that they need.
And a Korean War veteran took the microphone to say this center provides him one lunch a day. In Springfield, Dave Dahl, WJBC and WJBC.com.
From allegedly trying to have a local official killed to creating imaginary bad guys to mask his own suicide to embezzling to news that his widow and at least one child are being investigated, the story of Fox Lake Police Lieutenant Joe Glinowitz, which has embarrassed police who once honored him in death, has angles for everybody. President of the Illinois Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Randy Cox, says it's hard to speculate the effect the incident will have the next time a cop hits you up for a charitable contribution or the next time someone radios for help right before being killed.
You know, I think that's going to vary a lot by the individual department and the individual officer. You know, you would hope that it is a learning opportunity, at least for some departments. Maybe it's an additional training opportunity.
A spokesman for the Lake County Sheriff's Department says cocaine was found in the officer's desk, and there's evidence he tried to arrange a hit on the Fox Lake Village Administrator. Livingston County Coroner Mike Burke does not suspect foul play in the shooting deaths of two people in Cornell this week. Burke says 56-year-old Don Thorson and 62-year-old Wesley Thorson were found dead at their home on Saturday last week, and their deaths are considered an isolated incident. And the treatment of minorities by police is a common theme in stories heard about police violence. As WJBC's Joe Ragusa reports, the ACLU hosted a discussion this week to try and figure out when excessive force is needed.
Former local NAACP President Linda Foster says the issue of excessive force was brought into the spotlight because of instances where it was used against minorities. And it was good to see a diverse crowd at Wednesday's event.
To see the number of various age and backgrounds here proves that there are issues across the board. And it's just not one class of people. It's not one color of people that this is affecting.
The purpose of Wednesday's event was to dispel myths about when excessive or deadly force is used. ISU criminal justice professor Jason Ingram says it's a complicated problem, but a universal reporting system and set of guidelines for the use of force is a good place to start addressing it. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
The plan includes construction of a new sports complex for the Twin Cities, which a portion of the recent sales tax increase was partially intended to fund. But that might change because Bloomington is using its portion of the increase in different areas.
Question is, do we move forward with the sports complex? Is there something that we can do that's a little less expensive that the town can absorb? Do we find other funding partners that could assist in getting that complex completed?
City Manager Mark Peterson says the council still seems to see a need for a sports complex, and they'll spend the next year looking at alternatives. And a divided Illinois Supreme Court has again rejected a $10.1 billion class action judgment against cigarette maker Philip Morris over its marketing of low-tar tobacco products. The 4-2 ruling this week vacates a decision by Illinois' 5th District Appellate Court last year to reinstate a Madison County verdict. The lawsuit filed on behalf of hundreds of thousands of Illinois smokers had claimed that Philip Morris deceptively marketed light and low-tar cigarettes as a healthier alternative. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, an attorney for Kirk Zimmerman will ask a judge that the Bloomington man's bond be reduced in his murder trial for the death of his wife, Pamela Zimmerman. Also Monday, Donald Trump will be making a campaign stop at the Prairie Capital Convention Center in Springfield. Wednesday is Veterans Day. There will be ceremonies and observances throughout the area, including at Country Financial, Heartland Community College, and the YWCA in Bloomington. On Friday, Illinois State University will be hosting an awards ceremony following its week-long high-tech game of Capture the Flag. Also Friday, the Illinois State men's and women's basketball teams will open the season. The Redbird men visit San Diego State. The women travel to Bowling Green. The Illinois Wesleyan men's basketball team opens its season Saturday at home against Benedictine. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.